Going to turn the meeting over to my 15-minute speaker, Barbara.
I'm glad you made it.
Hi, my name's Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Barbara.
And nervous and kind of late, but anyway, I'm up here to tell you what it was like, how I got here, and what it's like now. And it's nice to be here because a year ago and 3 days, I came to my first meeting. Actually, it wasn't my first meeting, but I came wanting to stop drinking, and I came to the Freedom Fellowship. So a lot of the faces here are faces that I saw when I first came into the program. So it's nice to be here. But I grew up in this area, and we moved a lot. I was an only child, more or less. My voice is shaking so much. Can you hear it shaking? No? Okay. See my knees shaking? My brother is 13 years older than I am, so he wasn't around when I was growing up. And my parents moved a lot. We lived in apartments and never really had a stable home life like the kind I would watch on TV and that sort of thing. And my parents drank a lot, and I remember being kind of about this high, tugging at my dad's coat or my mom's purse to say, can we please go home? Can we leave the bar now? My dad taught tennis, and around all the tennis clubs at the time, there were bars, and it was a big thing that was the martini era for my parents. So I spent a lot of time in bars when I was little, from about 3 to maybe 8 years old. So I was around alcohol a lot. I was also around a lot of fighting around alcohol. And I think that has affected me in a lot of different ways still. My first drink that really mattered to me was when I was about 13. It was 8th grade, and it was a graduation. I should back up. My parents put me in a Catholic grammar school, and I think the intent was to provide a disciplinary system for me so they really didn't have to worry about it. If they put me in a college prep, I mean, this grammar school went right into a Catholic high school, which was supposed to get me right into college. The nuns would take care of me and teach me all the coping skills and everything, and they really didn't need to do it. So anyway, this graduation from 8th grade was from a Catholic grammar school. And I remember drinking not very large amount of whiskey and thinking, I can handle this. And it made me feel kind of proud that I could partake in something that I've been watching for so long. And it was more the act of doing the drinking. It didn't really affect me at that time. But throughout high school, I drank more and more. And people used to think that I was funny. I got much more of a personality when I drank, or I thought I did anyway. And I ran with a crowd that also liked to drink. So that by the time I graduated from high school, a typical weekend would be to get about 4 or 6 couples with 4 to 10 six-packs and go to the beach and not think anything of it and just drink all day and then continue to drink at night. I managed to keep keep everything else going, though. I didn't get kicked out of school. I had good grades. I didn't get in trouble with the law, except when I was 16, my boyfriend and I were caught by the police with beers in the car on the side of a road in Menlo Park, and he lost his license, and I was still under 16, and so I had to do a lot of community service. But I remember my father, when I came home from having this policeman arrest us and everything, I was in tears, and my dad said, what's the big deal? You didn't hurt anybody. I mean, it was okay, right? And he kind of made it seem okay, that was a normal thing to do. And looking back on it, I think that was one of the signs that didn't happen to all 16-year-olds. So anyway, the other thing, that was the only, I smoked a little bit of pot in high school, but it made me really tired, really hungry, and really stupid. So it never, and it did right up until the end. It wasn't a drug of choice. Sometimes made movies fun, but that was about it. So then I went away to college, and I went to UCLA, and that was my big move away from home. But my self-esteem had started to deteriorate at that point. Another thing I should mention is this private high school I went to, which was all girls, was expensive. And my parents didn't have very much money, but they wanted me in this school so badly, they worked out this arrangement where I worked at the school for my tuition. So I would be in the cafeteria serving my friends hot dogs or tacos or something like that. And that, I think, if I look back and associate some of the shame feelings that I had, I was ashamed of who I was because I wasn't really one of them. And but I never talked about it. But I remember when I would drink with my friends, then I was like them. In fact, I could even be superior to them because I could figure out their problems when I was drunk. And they thought I was great. But then I'd go back to school and have to be humiliated, which I didn't realize was happening at the time, but by working and serving my friends and things like that. I appreciate my schooling. I'm really glad I had the opportunity, but there were a lot of things in there, a lot of feelings that I didn't know I had until now. So I went away to college, and people at college didn't drink like I was used to drinking. I was very surprised that six-packs weren't around every weekend, and so my drinking, I cut down just because the environment changed. I guess that's a geographic in a way. But then I'd start doing weird things, like I hid a bottle of vodka in my dorm room closet, and I'd get frustrated with tests or something, and I'd sit out in the hall and kind of hold it and drink it in a very self-destructive way, in a self-depreciating way. And I remember my roommate just looking at me very scared and wondering why I was doing this to myself, and I don't really know. But college was really more of a demoralization for me socially, not academically. I graduated and got a degree that got me a job back here in electronics, so that part was okay. I managed to keep that end up, but my self-esteem was getting lower and lower. Another thing happened when I was in college. I came home my sophomore year to party with my friends. We'd all get back together in this area and go to parties. One of the problems I'd always had with drinking was I would get very tired very early because I drank a lot, and I could drink more than anybody or most other people. So by 9 o'clock, the life of the party was ready to go to bed, until my girlfriend introduced me to Coke. And the combination was perfect for me at the time, and that really is the beginning of the end as far as, I mean, it worked for a while, and it was kind of fun and different because I couldn't believe I could just keep partying for so long and not feel drunk and not have to go to sleep. I went back to college. I didn't have access to Coke, so it didn't get abused. I didn't abuse it, but when I got out of college and came back here, I went back to get my master's at night, so I was still doing the things that on the exterior looked successful. I had my own apartment and was going back to school and all that, but on the weekends, I'd go stay with my friends and do Coke all night Friday night, all night Saturday night, and then shape up again to go back to the routine on Monday, leading two completely separate lives. Nobody at work knew anything of what I did on the weekends, and I never talked about my work life to any of the people I partied with. So I was feeling a little bit lost there. I don't know quite what my identity was at the time. And I found a group of friends that played softball. They all partied like I did. It became very routine to have drinking, Coke-oriented weekends. I couldn't drink anymore without having the desire for that combination. And I started to think probably about 5 years ago, every once in a while I'd get a little flicker, this isn't right, or you can't live this way for the next, you know, for the rest of your life. Something's going to falter, but I didn't do anything about it, and I kind of pushed the thought away. Another thing that, I think I'm skipping some years here, but nothing, as far as work goes, I never really had any blackouts or any work-related drunks that got me in trouble at my job. I did have several blackouts in my drinking history. Usually when I was very, very embarrassed or humiliated, what I would do is drink really heavily, drink hard liquor that I knew I couldn't drink, and then I would just forget. Or I would get home and I wouldn't know how I got home. But these might happen once every 3 years or something, not regularly. But they would scare me. But I never thought I was an alcoholic. I thought it was just something I had done to myself and I could choose not to do if I wanted to. About 3 years ago, I started to get scared because every Friday night or every Friday afternoon at about 2 o'clock, all I wanted to do was go to the bar where I met all my friends. It was like a Cheers bar, but a little seedier. And but I loved it. I felt loved there and comfortable there because everybody drank together and partied together, and we all got on this level of what I thought was communication, and looking back on it, it really wasn't. But it kept me going for a long time. But I couldn't go through a Friday night without going there. I would try, and I'd try and drive by it and go home and just be by myself or do something different, and I couldn't do it, and I started to get scared. So I went to see a therapist to stop doing the Coke, but I still wanted to drink because I wanted to have Chardonnay in my life. It's really important to me that I had wine for the rest of my life for some reason. I just thought I could separate the two, and it didn't work. I did it for 3 months and tried to drink. I started drinking more, which meant I got tired earlier, and it was just like back when I was drinking before I started doing Coke. So that didn't work. Then I went through a six-month period where I just went back to doing everything the way I was. And then by this time, it's February of 1990, and I had this premonition or something that I was going to get a DUI. I knew it. And I told people about it, and I joked about it, that it was my time, and I was going to get one. And at the time, I had a company car for sales job that I had, and I had my old car in the garage because I didn't know if I liked the job well enough, and if I quit, I needed my other car. So I said, told my friends, we're all going out for margaritas, I'm going to go home and get my other car because I'm going to get a DUI tonight and I don't want to get a DUI in the company car. And they're looking at me really weird, like, that's just a strange thing to wish upon yourself. And I proceeded to get drunk on margaritas and drive from the bar to my dealer's house and do Coke for like 3 to 4 in the morning and then feel miserable and have heart palpitations and think I was going to die, which happened all the time. And never got the DUI, and I thought it was real strange. A week later, I got the DUI. And it was right after a company function that I organized, so I was with work people wearing my finest little wool suit and driving down Central Expressway to go from one bar where I'd been with all work people at 10 at night to another bar in Palo Alto to see all my Cheers friends, and I got pulled over and taken in. And it was the scariest experience of my life. I felt my human rights had been stripped. They didn't like me, and they made it clear, and I was just really, really scared, and so that was a turning point, but I didn't stop drinking or doing anything else. I was just scared. My court date was 4 months later. When I went to my court date, they gave me a restricted license. I could drive only to and from work, so I never drank during the week, and my friends drove me around to parties on the weekends. That August, I was getting my license back, and I was scared because if I had any alcohol in my blood at all, in the next 5 years, it was an automatic second DUI, license suspension, 6 months jail, on and on and on, and I was scared to death of that, and I knew that I couldn't socially drink and not get in trouble, and I didn't know what to do, and I am fortunate enough to have a friend in the program who I was watching the attraction instead of promotion really work for me, and I was lucky enough to have her there with me and tell her that I'm ready. I'm ready to go into the program. I want what you have. I want that ability to be peaceful and comfortable with myself and not have to drink at every occasion that I go to, be it a wedding, be it a picnic, whatever. So I guess, you know, I didn't lose everything, but I had lost everything because there was nothing left inside. I was ashamed of who I was. I didn't know who I was anymore. So I'm really grateful that I came into the program when I did, and it's just been uphill ever since. And I've met, one of the biggest fears I had was who will I be friends with? I have all these old friends that I've been with for years, and now I'm not going to drink, and they're not going to like me, and I'm going to be home alone, and I'm not going to have anything to do. And I've met more friends in this program than I think I've had, I can't say in my life if I added them all up, but they're deeper friendships, and they're friendships that deal with what's going on in reality, not what's going on in some fog of alcohol and drugs. And they mean everything to me, and this fellowship means everything to me. All the meetings I go to give me what I need to stay sober, and that's what I'm going to do. So thank you for the opportunity to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Hi, my name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Now, all of you guys are here for one speaker meeting. I get three tonight. I get the speaker meeting that happened on the way up here, the one that you're going to hear, and the one that's going to happen on the way home. I'm real glad... Oh, excuse me.
No, you're fine.
Okay. I'm real glad to be in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I'm also very proud that my dad's here in the room tonight. That means a lot to me, because of the fact that There was a period in my life where I didn't want to have anything to do with them. And more important than that is I didn't want to have anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And he, at that particular time, I didn't want to have anything to do with him. He represented in my mind Alcoholics Anonymous because he was sober. Now, as you hear a little bit about my story and about my recovery, I hope that you can identify with the fact that Tom is an alcoholic and that you too might suffer the same disease of alcoholism that I suffer. Although I don't feel I suffer it anymore, but I sure did for a long time. Geez, I can shake out the nervousness a little bit. I believe my first drink was when I was 9, because I can't really remember a whole lot of my life. But I believe it was 9. It was Thanksgiving. I was at my aunt's house, my Aunt Dorothy. And everybody got called for the Thanksgiving turkey dinner, and we were upstairs watching the football games, and they were having highballs. And they went all downstairs, and I stayed upstairs and started drinking some of the highballs. I didn't drink anything for the next year, but I did think constantly about getting back to Aunt Dorothy's house because I knew I could drink there again. And now it took me about 2 years of sobriety to realize that that was the first mental obsession that I could relate to in my story. My first drunk, I was 13. I was drinking cooking wine from out underneath the oven. And I just drank as much as I could, and I threw up. And my little brother came in because I was making so much noise, so I made him drink. And he just drank the glass and left it and went on to bed, and I kept on drinking and kept on throwing up and kept on cleaning up the mess. I never did like red wine, but that didn't stop me from drinking. I know that in between my first drink and my first drunk, there was alcohol in my life because, you know, every time there was a family situation, there was always wine on the table. And not always did I know if I was supposed to have some or not, but, you know, as we were washing dishes, whatever was left in the glass, I'd take. The typical things that a lot of alcoholics do. Now, when I got into high school, I was pretty much clean cut. I didn't party on a regular basis. What I did was, if there was any social drinking in my life, it was when I was in high school. A couple beers on the weekend, washing and waxing the car, going to parties here and there, and having a couple highballs. Bourbon was my drink of choice. But the important thing that happened to me, and is basically where I shut down and became a rebel, was all through high school, I was in a relationship with this gal. And we were going to go off and get married and live happily ever after. Well, that didn't come to be the facts. We decided to take a test and go out and meet other people during the summer. We'll get back together in the fall as we went off to college and stuff. And well, she decided she didn't want to get married. And I could not face that same group of people that I had socialized with all through high school. So I went to the neighborhood park with a six-pack of beer and started meeting the guys that were hanging out, twisting the joints and taking acid, and doing the things that was done in that crowd. So when I was 19, I started drinking on a daily basis. And I'd also started taking a lot of speed. And I mean a lot of speed. Remember, I was working at Der Wienerschnitzel, having about 6 to 8 pots of coffee in a 4-hour shift and 20 to 30 whites. And the doctor told me that I should cut out coffee. Because I didn't tell him I was taking the speed. But down the road, with, you know, the introduction of light drugs, marijuana and speed and reds and acid and all that stuff, I found that I was really addicted to speed, and I needed to get out of the area. And I went over to Modesto area and went to the junior college over there, and I was able to kick the speed habit. Just as easy as that. I just left it. Well, I shouldn't say easy as that. You know, I did what a lot of alcoholics do. I substituted. I drank more beer then, even though bourbon was my drink of choice. I drank more beer, and I also quit smoking cigarettes when I was detoxing, or whatever you want to call it, getting rid of the speed. Because I found that every time I smoked a cigarette, I wanted to take some wipes. Yeah, and it's just, they went hand in hand. It took me probably 6 months to get a group of friends over in that area over in the Central Valley. And what I did on a regular basis was I came back over here to get a pound of pot. And I wasn't 21 yet, but I was able to go into most of the stores in the Modesto area and buy without being carded. I remember, like it was yesterday, the look on the guy's face at the store across the street from where I live when he finally carded me 2 days after my 21st birthday. Yeah. One of the things that happened to me, which is just, I just remembered it recently, is that probably 2 or 3 months after I turned 21, I was living with who eventually became my first wife over in Modesto, and I got sick. And I know it was because of the way I was partying. I knew that I was doing too much PCP at the time, and I refused to let anybody in the house that was doing PCP. But over a period of time, in this little party house, I got dehydrated. I wasn't able to eat anything for about a period of, eat or drink anything at all, for about a period of 3 weeks. I smoked plenty of grass, but my mom had to come over from the Santa Clara County and pick me up and take me home. And I don't remember much about that except for that did happen. And I think the reason why I remember that was because of the fact that I was reading the book the other night with one of the guys I sponsor, and we're talking about how alcohol physically can really take us down the tubes. I didn't think about that until just in the last few weeks. Anyway, I came back here with a new wife and found work in a waterbed manufacturer place. And our typical day there, it was great. I'd smoke a joint on the way to work. I know we're talking Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is Tom, so bear with it if you don't like talking about pot and what have you. But typical morning was smoking a joint on the way to work with the guys, getting to work and waiting for the boss to show up. Now the boss was coming from Santa Cruz Mountains, and as we were waiting, we'd all be smoking more dope, and there'd be maybe 20 guys out there. The boss would show up and say, "Okay, nobody punch in the time card yet," because he'd open up the time card and roll it back to 8 o'clock and be maybe 8:30 or so. And then we'd all punch in and he'd put the time back in again. But in the meantime, we're all just getting loaded out on the side waiting for him to show up. I found out about 2 or 3 weeks later that the whole business was under IRS seizure because of the fact that the original owners of the place were running drugs and they got in a plane crash and got killed. And through the investigation, the IRS came in. But that's where I developed some work ethics that were just basically partying, period. You know, I mean, the lunch truck came and they'd have beer on there for us. You know, I mean, that's against the law to do, but that's what they brought to this place where I was working. Down the road, I got divorced, and I don't know in what order it was, but down the road I got divorced and I started my own business. Got divorced first and started my own business. What I do is upholstery, and I learned how to the basic skills in the waterbed business. And then I was looking for work, and one of the vendors said that there was a little upholstery shop right down the street from here, actually, over on Commercial, that needed an upholsterer. And I didn't know how to do what they did, but they taught me. And we had a recession. And during the recession, the regular orders went way down. And money was real tight. And that's when I started my own business and I was working out of the garage. I remember the very first thing I did was my mom's sofa. And I remember my mom came by and visited me while I was working on it. And I was on my on my hands and knees, and she said, that's a good place for you. You need to pray a lot to be able to do this. I was doing that in a friend's garage. But, you know, and all the time, I'm just partying up the yin-yang. The business went from a point where it was just on the weekends while I had another job, and I quit the job and opened a storefront and the whole development, to where at a particular point, I think it was 1976, we opened up a shop in Los Gatos, and I had a partner. My particular appearance at that time, I felt that I couldn't go out and do any sales calls. I was fully bearded. My hair was down in the middle of my back, and I usually reeked. You know, if I wasn't a reefer, it was a bourbon. Because my typical day at that period of time was two or three joints before I'd get out of the house, an ounce and a half or 3 ounces of bourbon or 151 rum in the coffee and tea before I hit the door to go to work. And the liquor store down the street would open at 10 o'clock, and I'd get a six-pack. And I usually had help with it, but anyway, it was gone at noon. So there was the liquor store again a little later, and a hard booze. And like I said, bourbon was my drink of choice, so there was every time anybody come to visit me at work, which a lot of people did, they'd always be able to have a shot of bourbon with me, and I was always glad to see them so I could have a shot of bourbon and not feel guilty. One of the songs that was popular at the time said, like, it was a Who song, talked about teenage wasteland. And I used to sit there and pride myself that I wasn't as bad as those guys that came in to visit me. Yet, what I know today is that my tolerance was the fact that I was just on an even keel. My hands didn't shake. I was so loaded that, I was just toxic all the time. Anyway, in 78, I'd pretty much come to the conclusion, like Barbara said earlier, that I couldn't keep living this way. You know, I was just going through about $400 of marijuana a week. I didn't buy any cocaine, but I sure did a lot of it. And my life was just totally unmanageable. I wasn't making $400 a week, but I was spending more than that on drugs and alcohol. And this is where I knew I couldn't keep going that way. And I went to my first AA meeting. And my dad was sober somewhere around a year. And I asked him. Another thing that just occurred to me now that I should share with you, at this period of my life, I was on constant monitoring for my blood pressure. So it was pretty apparent to me that I couldn't keep going the way I was going. I don't know how often people were coming into the house, but I was being monitored for my high blood pressure. And I went to this AA meeting, and I remember sitting at St. Luke's in Los Gatos on a hot summer night. I remember this little girl, couldn't have been more than 15 or 16 years old, and I was 25 years old, and she was sitting out there on the bench, drinking wine out of a brown paper bag. And I could tell that she wanted to come in. The way she'd look at that bag, she'd look at it, and she'd put it aside, and she'd scoot over a couple inches, and she'd listen to the people in the meeting. And I was paying a lot of attention to her, because what was going on in the meeting, I didn't really care for that much. Anyway, I remember her, and I think constantly, when I share this with other people, about the alcoholic who still suffers that doesn't have the ability to recover from the disease of alcoholism. And I'm real grateful that I've been able to recover. Anyway, at that meeting, I remember the couple funny things that happened was, like, I was introduced to people around the tables, and there was a sheet of paper. That's 1978. You signed up if you wanted somebody to call you. And, of course, they knew my dad. I was with my dad and what later turned into be his new wife. So I figured the people knew who I was. So I put my name and somebody else's phone number. I don't know whose, but I wasn't capable of, I wanted to help, yet I wasn't capable of taking it. I wasn't. That night, I got dropped off and I went right to the liquor store and I got a bottle of Jack Daniels and I got drunk. And I woke up with a tremendous hangover because I hadn't had anything for a few days or maybe even a few weeks as far as I know. Before I went to that meeting, I was pretty sober before I went to that meeting. And I got up in the morning and I said, well, I guess I'm just going to drink, and it's better than doing drugs. And I was able for a period of probably 6 or 7 months to control my drinking. I mean, I wasn't getting to the point where I'd have to hide bottles in the closets like I was just a few months before. And I wasn't doing the drugs. I felt good about myself. And pretty soon I was just drinking around the clock again. I don't know how it happened, but I like to just call it like a gutter drunk. I was waking up in the morning to have to fortify myself to get out of the bedroom. And I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I was shaking so bad that I just couldn't stand being in my own skin. I'd have to fortify myself with 4 or 5 ounces of alcohol, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, just to be able to go back and pass out again. And then I met wife number two somewhere in that neighborhood. And in fact, it was just about 2 months after I went to that first meeting. And she was astonished that I could sit there at a party and people would be lining out lines of cocaine and I could just sit there and say no.
Yeah.
But a year or two later, she was sitting there and she'd got to know Tom a little bit better, and she was calling me an alcoholic. She was saying that if I didn't quit drinking, that she was going to leave. So this is about 1981 that this particular thing started happening. And I would again stop for a period of time. Most of the time is when I'd go back to that same doctor that told me to quit drinking coffee years and years ago. And he put me on antabuse. He had a lot of serious talks with me. But in fact, some of the serious talks were that he wanted me to go to this little place on Forest Avenue. They call it an outpatient program. And I was going to have somebody that I could talk to about my alcoholism. And this is, I believe that was in 1983 that we talked about that. Anyway, every time I stopped drinking on my own, and I want to really impress it upon you people that it was on my own. I did not come back to Alcoholics Anonymous until I got sober. I went to a few meetings here and there from pressure from the wife. And she went to Al-Anon a little bit, but it all came to a head and it was just too much for her and she finally left. But what I know about the disease of alcoholism as it relates in my story is somewhere around 82, 83, you know, I quit drinking and I'd go maybe 6 months on antabuse, and I think I went close to 3 months without taking anything as far as antabuse and just cold sober, and it was nuts. It was crazy. This lady who had told me for quite a period of time that if I didn't stop drinking, she was going to leave. She was living with me. I was so crazy. After not drinking, she poured me my first drink. And everything went fine for about 4 to 5 months. I was able to have a few beers here and there. I never got out of control until one day I woke up and there was a bottle in the garage, a bottle in the office, a bottle in the medicine cabinet up where she couldn't see it, and I was hiding bottles everywhere and drinking around the clock again. In that period, it's still, you know, my memory isn't the best, I tell you. Sometimes things just flash upon me. But during that period, there was a lot of nights where I'd wake up on the sofa with booze spilled all over me, or just, you know, hanging on to a bottle. And where I wanted to be the most was in bed with my wife, that I was incapable of staying in bed for more than 2 or 3 hours without waking up shaking like a leaf. So I'd have to go out and do what I had to do. Anyway, she left right after my birthday. Oh, this is important too. You know, my first wife, she said that I was an alcoholic, and I said, okay, I'll get through the holidays. I quit drinking on my birthday. Okay, I told that to her. My second wife, I told that to her. I said, I'll get through the holidays. My birthday is January 31st. Christmas, New Year's, you got to be able to drink through that. And I was never able to do that. She left on February 2nd, 1985. Because there it was again. I got to my birthday, and I drank, and I was a drunk, and so she left. When she walked out the door, she said that she was going to take me for everything I had. I went to the psychiatrist and got put on antabuse. The thought that was in my mind is that I got to stay sober through this divorce. That was the thought that was in my mind. It was very predominant. At that time, this little business that I started in the backyard in the garages was going about $120,000 a year, and it was my pride and joy. Yeah. So I got on antabuse. I worked 16 hours a day, and I didn't take anything. But I don't think I was sober, because what I did take, and I think this is important for the new person that thinks he can take something, although there might be some people around here that might say that, well, yeah, you were sober, but like I was taking antabuse and some other antidepressant and dexedrine to wake up and Somnex to go to sleep. And I was going through this divorce, this separation. We weren't divorced. We didn't even think about divorce until for a long time. But I was going through this separation. She went and moved in with her folks. I had six people working for me. My family was just down the street. My little sister wasn't too far away. Most of my family is right in the general area, not too far away. But the thing is, I was going through all this heartache, and I didn't tell a soul. I didn't tell a soul. My best friend at the time was probably 62 years old. He had his business right next to mine, and he liked to drink the way I liked to drink. Yet he'd seen me go on and off the wagon for 4 years, and he had this little girlfriend of his, and she was the one I confided with. After 10 months of living in that pain, I sat there and I called her up and I said, "I got to talk to somebody. Can I come over and talk?" She said, "Sure, come on over, have a beer." And then she stopped herself right there. She said, "No, I got Pepsi. Come on over," because she knew I was on the wagon and she knew how much it meant to me not to drink. And I sat there and I told her what was going on in my life, and it was the first time I talked about the separation. I didn't even talk to my wife about it that much. I refused to look at the fact. So I dumped this with her, and she comes out with another Pepsi and for me and a beer for her, and she rolled the joint and said, "Here, smoke this. It won't hurt you." And I hadn't smoked any weed since 1978, and this is 1985. I didn't think anything of it. I didn't know any better, really. A couple weeks later, I was buying bags, you know. And it was good. I had absolutely no intention of drinking whatsoever. I stopped taking the antabuse. I stopped going to the shrink. I started sleeping with my best friend's girlfriend. And I took that first drink on Christmas Eve, 1985. And a strong voice in my head said, "You got control." And I put it down, and I didn't touch it for the rest of that night. And I woke up the morning, and I felt good. I was packing the van up to go on a little vacation with some living that I had. And she said, "Well, are you going to bring this bottle?" And I said, "No, I'm not going to drink." And I went over to the family cabin, and I went a couple days, and all I was doing was twisting joints and smoking a little bit here and a little bit there. And I ran across a bottle of Seagram 7 in the bottom cupboard. And I had a few snips off it here and there, but I was under control. And then New Year's Eve, 1986, I went all day without doing anything. I was going to prime myself. Grateful Dead were going to be on TV and on the radio. And I was going to sit at home, smoke a few numbers, and all of a sudden it came to me that I should go back and find that pint. And I found that pint, and I poured another drink, and I just straight on ice, good Seagram 7. And I capped that one, and that same voice came back and said, "You got it now. You got it licked." So a half hour later, when it was hitting midnight, I went and I poured a second drink. And then the disease had me in its grips full force, because I don't remember a thing until Super Bowl Sunday. Best my recollection today, that's usually 3 weeks. I woke up in this friend's house who, a couple months beforehand, I was sitting there, I was spilling my guts to her, and I woke up and I had a bottle of Absolut Vodka, a bottle of Seagram 7, a six-pack of Corona beer, a six-pack of Bud Light, a vial of cocaine, and a bag of weed. And it was good weed, too. Pooh. And I didn't know how I got there. I had absolutely no idea. I found out a couple days later that I'd been sleeping with her all this period of time. Because I didn't know. I had no idea. And So I was going to go talk to my friend about it, and she comes by and she says, nope, he doesn't know a thing about it. We can keep this under wraps. Sounded good to me. But what had happened is I started, you know, again, stuffing this stuff. And I'd go out in real life, and we had our businesses right next to each other. We'd go out for these nice business lunches, and there's no clue. He had absolutely no clue. What I did is I started drinking, because I was so ashamed of my own behavior, I started drinking even heavier. Not too long after that, the IRS came a little visit at my home when I was hung over one morning and wasn't able to get to work on time. And they basically said that they were on to me. And I looked at what was going on, and it didn't look like it was a big deal. It really wasn't, in February 1986, a big deal. It wasn't. But I drank and used. Came and let me know that they were on to me, you know. So I took a little time off, and I was going to stop drinking so I could get my papers in order. I went over to this family cabin again, which my brother lives very close to, and I asked him if he would help me put my financial matters in order, and that the IRS was right, you know, one step behind me. And he said, sure. So he said, why don't you go back and don't drink anything and don't use anything, and tomorrow afternoon we'll get together. Well, I did that. And we got together and we looked at my finances that evening and saw that I was in a lot worse shape in August than I was in February, because I hadn't paid them a thing as far as all the employees that I had. And I decided, well, that's it. I got to straighten up. Just got to do it. I went into the shop a couple days later, told all my employees that there's no more drinking or using until after 5 o'clock. And that went well with them. The first couple days, they had absolutely no problem. The third day, I had a major problem. I had to leave and get drunk. And the fourth day, and the fifth day, and the sixth day, and the seventh day, I could not stay away from alcohol. September 16th, now I can remember that like it was yesterday, too. Because this is the turning point in my life, even though I didn't know it then, and whatever. I woke up that morning, and my arm didn't work. And I thought I was asleep. I thought I would wake up, and it didn't wake up. And I went into the shower to shampoo my hair. I figured a little hot water on the shoulder, and it would come to, and it didn't wake up. So I'm getting ready to shampoo my hair, and my hand doesn't work. Just closes up automatically. Some people know what that's called. I don't pretend to know. But it was that morning where I was down and out. And I was crying. And I was tetrified. I was so terrified what was going on. And I just cried out. I can't do this. I just can't do it. I asked for help. I asked God for help that morning. And 2.5 months later, I finally got into that treatment center that the doctor tried to get me into in 1983. That's a long drunk-a-log, but that's a drunk-a-log. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous has gotten me to a point where I need to remember that all the time, especially after you share about not going to meeting and getting drunk. It happens every day. Yeah. My bottom, I believe, was a high bottom, because of the people that I know on the program. But so on December 7th, I had my last drink. I went into a treatment program. It was an outpatient program. They wanted to put me inpatient. I was ready to go inpatient. They looked at my insurance papers. It said on there, acute alcoholic, and they wouldn't take it. I ended up going to O'Connor's at Campbell on outpatient. The very first day, I went in there. I was angry. I said, my name's Tom Olson. I'm an alcoholic. Are your parents alcoholics? And there was 2 people out of 8 that said their parents were alcoholic, and the rest of them said no. And the treatment center coordinator, the doctor came up and said, Tom, you're angry? And I said, no, I'm not. And he said, you are an alcoholic. It's in your file. You've accepted yourself to come into treatment. There's only one thing that you can do to stay sober. To live. No, I didn't say stay sober. He says, there's only one thing you can do to live, and that's stay away from alcohol. And this treatment center does not have a fix for alcoholism. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he says, you have to go to AA meetings. So those are the 2 things that I wanted to do the least in my life, was go to AA meetings and to meet up with my dad. But 3 weeks later, I met up with my dad. I was going to outpatient programs from 4 to 8 every day, smoking weed from 10 to 12 every night. That's my story. But 3 weeks later, I met up with my dad. It was New Year's Eve, 1987, exactly 1 year after I took that drink and went through all that hell that I went through in 1986. And that hell is what I call living prison. Most of the time, I did not want to drink. When I told the guys at the office that there wasn't going to be any alcohol until after 5 o'clock, I felt that I could do it. I was sure I could do it. I'd stopped before, but I couldn't, and I didn't. Anyway, I got out of that treatment program. I moved my residence. On January 26th, the IRS came in, seized the business. It flattened me. They took away my baby. That was it. That's all I had left. I'd already had a sponsor, and I'd already talked to him a couple times in his car, and I was high. But he just sat there, and he told me to go back and read the book and try to comprehend what the book has to say, and I'd meet with him again. Anyway, there was a birthday meeting. It was the last Saturday in January. I had no idea what day it was. I knew I was going to go to an AA meeting. It was a speaker meeting, my very first speaker meeting that I had any recollection of. I sat with my stepmom and some of the girls that she sponsored. A lot of them got chips that night. My sponsor asked me to help clean up. I cleaned up, and he says, maybe you better come back to the midnight. So I came back to the midnight. I was every intention in the world to go home and roll another joint. I did. My sponsor called on me in that meeting, and I was walking up to the podium, and I was going to tell you people how wonderful your program was. I loved being sober, and that I was going to be back again tomorrow. But what came out of my mouth was, hey, I've been sitting here for a couple months. I'm still getting loaded. I need help. And I had no intention of saying that. That was January 31st, 1987. That's my sobriety date. I went home that night and threw away the pot, and I wanted to get loaded, but I didn't. My ego kicked in, I think, kept me sober for the first few days. I started standing up in meetings, and my stepmom came over and said, so what's going on? So I told her, well, I've been smoking weed all the time, and when's your sobriety day? So I sit there and figure it out, and go, well, it was Saturday night. So we're walking out to the cars, and she says, Tom, it's your birthday. And I know I could have never got sober on my birthday, because I tried. I tried for a long time to sober up on my birthday, and you people gave that to me. And thank God it hasn't changed. Now it doesn't have to. That was January 31st, January 7th. I was at the lawyer. No, February 7th, I was at the lawyer's office filing for divorce. And I was high on the program. I was high on life. I sat there and I looked at this lawyer, my wife's lawyer, and I said, we'll just take care of it. I said, sure, $100 a week alimony, no problem. She says, how are you going to do that? I go, don't worry about it. And I pulled out my chip from O'Connor's, the commencement chip, and I showed it to him. And he pulled out his chip, and he had 4 years in the program at the time. I went through a lot of growth periods with that divorce thing, but what's more important is, like, that was on the 7th of February, I believe. And the following Monday, I was down at the IRS, eyeball to eyeball with that agent, saying, whatever it takes, I've got this guy who's going to do this financial arrangements, and we're going to open up the business again, and I'm going to make you payments. And I've been making payments from that day until this. Those things were big things. A couple weeks later, we noticed that all the creditors hadn't been, I didn't have any idea, but we noticed that all the creditors were quite late in being paid, and the new owner of the business wasn't going to take care of that, so my ninth step tripled just in one day. I did what I needed to do. I worked the steps in 90 days, and I started sponsoring people.
And if there's anything that I have to say about Alcoholics Anonymous, it is sponsorship has saved my rear end. Sponsorship has showed me. Without a shadow of a doubt. Without a shadow of a doubt. I've been working with others since I was 30 days sober. My sponsor told me that 10, 11, and 12 are maintenance steps. If you got one day of sobriety, you need to maintain it. Because it was real apparent to me that I could get cocky and I could drink again. You know, one thing that I know that the feeling in my gut, like when the IRS came on Monday, I got sober on Saturday, I wanted to drink on Monday. You know, and I hadn't wanted to drink all the time I was smoking weed. And after I was getting ready to go down to the lawyer's office, I just had it in me. I don't know how. I just had it. I knew that I was going to be okay. Now, through the process of the steps that I've had this spiritual awakening, but I got to tell you, at each and every one of those steps, I had a spiritual experience. And what it was just knowing that Alcoholics Anonymous was going to take care of me. I had my good friend, Cece. She wasn't my good friend then. She was a friend that I was just beginning to know. But every day she would just sit there and just let me be. I'd just sit down next to her and just let me be. And she showed me that that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does. You can just come into this room, or any other room like it, and just be yourself. Now, I don't know if I know myself today. I know that I haven't drank. I know that there's a lot of important principles behind every step, and we could talk about them. I could talk about them all night long. I think I'm only supposed to talk for 45 minutes. Is that right? Okay. So I'll wrap it up here in the next few minutes, letting you know that there was somebody in the fellowship that wasn't my sponsor, but he kind of took me under his wing by giving me temporary sponsor slips. He was giving me 2 to 3 slips a week for me to call people. It took almost 40 slips for me to get somebody that was willing to work with me. And he was an atheist like you wouldn't believe. Boy, he hated the word God. He was at the Pate House, and we worked for 2 solid months on his conception of a higher power. And I got a lot out of that, I can tell you that. Boy, you know, because I always took God for granted. I always used him as a pitch hitter. But I always knew he was there. I always knew God. I never got drunk enough to throw God out of my life. But he sure did. You know. So working with him helped me a lot. But this particular gentleman that would give me these slips, usually on Friday, right before the weekend, kept me busy on the weekend. He'd also say, every time he came up to the podium, he'd sit there and say, you know, there's some things that are indispensable in this program. And that's honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And he'd look at those and point out the fact that, you know, look at the first 3 steps. You got to be honest to take the first step. And I know that it took a lot for me to get gut honest with myself, to have that 2-foot drop to where I knew I was an alcoholic. And more important than that I knew I was hopeless without outside help. And I became open-minded to somebody else's idea of what would get me sober. See, it was always my way or the highway. Always. When it came to booze. You know, I could take your suggestions and follow your advice at everything else except for the way I was drinking. And step 3, looking at the willingness to change. I needed those things desperately when I got here. The how of the program. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. He's since moved out of the area, but I get together with him twice a year, and it's really a really important thing for me. It really is. The connections that I've made in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's quite a few people in this room. I know Roger's sitting over there half asleep, but my dad, or concentrating, one or the other. My dad was chairing a meeting, and I don't know, we were maybe 2 or 3 months sober. And that's where we met, at this meeting my dad was chairing on the first step. The very first time I spoke at an AA meeting, I believe. And every time Roger and I see each other, you know, it gets us right back in the beginning. What it was like when we had to get sober. And we had to get sober. Roger had some physical things too, you know. The first time I did my 4-step, I did it right out of the book. Thank God, because sometimes I'll need to do a 4-step. And I'll try to do it some other way, and it won't work. And I got those tools right there. just list the stupid things. And when I list the damn resentments, I get free because I can get into the real the meat of the thing, which is always my part of the action. The first time I went full circle with a fifth step. The guy, unfortunately, is not sober today, but I felt like I was lifted off the ground. Literally. And then when I did my first fifth step, I was kind of, you know, still real foggy. And when I did my second fifth step, the divorce was final, and I'd ran the steps on the divorce. You know, I was in a relationship with somebody else, and I was a real confused cookie. And I did this fourth and fifth step. Man, I was rocketed. And I went home. It was just real quick, the background was there was a big party that night, and every time I came across another step, I did one, two, and that, okay, I'm going to just do three, and then I'm going to go party. It's a sobriety party, you know, but anything. I had this other thing in my mind. I was going to do it. Three came, and the thought came to my mind, it's useless unless I want to take an inventory. So I wrote down some things, and then I was going to go to the party. Well, you've got to call your sponsor, at least see if he's home. So I call him, he's home. Jesus, he's never home on a Friday night. That's the night he spends with his wife, you know. So I went over and I dumped it, and I'm going to go to this party. Well, that same voice comes in. Once you do five, you have to go home and look for an hour on six and seven. And so I went home, and I tell you, at that point, I sat there and I looked at my watch. I said, okay, I can still get to the party. And I closed my eyes. And I came to an hour later with the most warm feeling in my chest that I've ever experienced in my life. The only way I could describe it at the time was like he put a whole tube of deep heating rub on my chest and took away all the pain and all the guilt and all the remorse that I ever had in my whole life. And it just was all lifted. And this was the second time I ran the steps. You know, step eight always tells me that I have to continuously re-examine what I'm doing. Always have to re-examine what I'm doing. Step nine is something I'm still doing. I'm still paying the IRS. I probably always will. But the most important amends were those that I took care of with the people in my life. And walking the walk is the most important. I have a sister that... it's hard to tell if she's sober or not, but I know she needs a lot of help. And it's all I can do is walk the walk and be an example, a living example of what this program has to offer. That's all I can do in that area. And, you know, like I said before, 10, 11, and 12 are the maintenance steps of this program. And I learn so much every time I get a resentment at you about what Tom is all about. So I know that I'm never going to get cured, and I'm grateful for that. Because most of my adult life, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I degressed. I stopped living. I was on that so slow suicidal binge. Yeah. One thing that just happened to me in the last few months, say, when I got sober, I had to make amends to my old business partner. And I saw him this spring. Again, after I'd made the amends and everything was cool and he'd been giving me work, and in fact I actually gave him some work, and he was getting ready to move up to another state, and I saw him in Los Gatos at this little festival, and God, he looked good, and I looked good, and we read some, what's that word, we just talked about the past a little bit and went on our own ways. But the feeling that I had when he sat there and brought up some of the things, like when I stopped doing smoking marijuana, I couldn't work for 2 weeks straight, according to him. I couldn't cut a straight line. I couldn't do anything straight unless I was loaded. See, I forget about those things. I forget about those things. So I keep coming here, listening to people do what I'm doing tonight. Listen to people in institutions that talk about, how did it ever happen? So this one guy not too long ago said he had 15 years of sobriety. Just down the street here at Work Furlough, he had 15 years of sobriety, stopped going to meetings, and wound up with 4 DUIs and doesn't know how. And I think about my 3-week blackout is chicken shit compared to that stuff. So I don't ever want to go back where I came from, and with you people, I never do. And that's 45 minutes. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Tom. Lord's Prayer.